This is The Guardian.
Noor Haider here, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is the full story.
We're walking now through Elbrus camp. It's dusty, a lot of broken tents, pretty run down. The camp is segmented into different segments for different nationalities, and we're talking to the Australians today.
This week, journalist William Christou made the long journey to Al-Roj camp in northeastern Syria.
And there are about 2,000 families here from 55 different nationalities. There's a lot of stray dogs in the camp, high barbed wire fences. There's a sense of resignation among the residents here. Kids playing, not much to do, their lives confined to just a few square kilometers.
Among the families, 23 Australian children and 11 women related to Islamic State fighters who've been held there since the group was defeated. They attempted to leave the camp last week with hopes of making it to Australia, but were forced to turn back. Now they're at the centre of a political storm, unwanted and unwelcome by the Australian government, amid an increasingly hostile anti-immigration debate and rising support for One Nation.
We're going to speak to their children and hear about what life is like here in this camp. Many of them don't know life outside of the camp, spent their whole life here.
I don't want to be in a camp. I don't want to be in a prison. I just want to go and be free. And live a normal life, not like you.
Today, we hear from the children Australia has abandoned.
Please, help us get out of this place. I can't handle this anymore.
Hi, William. It's great to have you back on Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
You are joining us from Syria. You've just visited Al-Roj camp, and you've spoken to some of the Australian families stranded there. Can you describe the journey to the camp?
So it was a long one. I was coming from Beirut. You know, I think like everyone else, last week when we heard about the repatriation attempt by the Australians, we were all taken a little back and the chaos that happened when they got returned back. And so we rushed over, and it was from Beirut. It's about a 12-hour journey. But as you drive towards the camp, which is located really high up there by the Iraqi border, in a sparse sort of deserty area, you get the sense of just how remote everything is. It's far away from everything. You know, what you see are livestock, sheep herders, and oil wells pumping. And then all of a sudden you stumble upon this camp. And once you're inside, you know, it kind of seems like you could be anywhere because you have no sense of the outside world. You can't see over the walls. And there's sort of a timeless placelessness to it.
It is hard to comprehend the conditions inside the camp. Was it difficult to track down the Australian families, and was it difficult to get access inside?
No, I think, you know, right now in Syria, we're at a point where the question of what's going to happen to these foreign families is on everyone's minds. We saw last month that the Syrian government took over a whole camp, which previously was the biggest camp in the world for suspected members of ISIS and their families. And what happened after was that nearly all 25,000 residents of that camp either left or were smuggled out. Now, Al-Roj is the only ISIS camp left. It holds mainly women and children who are related to suspected ISIS members. And the question on everyone's mind is, what's going to happen next? And so I think that the Kurdish forces that guard this camp are very eager to have foreign countries come in and take their residents out. So they were happy to give us access and to talk to people. For context, the camp is about a little over 2,200 people from 55 different nationalities. And so it's a big effort for the Kurds to guard this camp, and also a big effort to get them to get countries to take back their citizens.
there are 23 Australian children detained there with their mothers. You met and spoke to them. How are they holding up and what did they say?
Yeah, so we spent over the course of 2 days, about 5 hours with these Australian mothers and their children. And they showed us what life was like there. And it's rough. The kids and the mothers both were in a state of shock, I think, after what happened last Monday.
12 hours by car.
And we talked to some of the kids. And, you know, one of them, for example, asked it.
How old are you, Asya?
9 years old.
9 years old. Okay. And what do you like to do for fun?
I like to sing and dance.
You like to sing and dance?
Yeah.
Okay. Very nice.
She was put in a camp when she must have been 1 year old. So she doesn't remember anything outside of the camp. So the first time that she saw the outside world anywhere outside of this small camp was on Monday last week when she was taken out of the camp to be released to Australia, was what they were hoping for. And she was out of the camp for about an hour.
So it was very exciting.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How come?
I was very happy.
What did you see?
There's houses, trees. I saw houses for the first time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What did they look like?
They have buildings and...
Did you see trees and animals?
Yeah.
Which animals did you see?
I saw a donkey. I saw sheep.
Yeah?
I saw a cow.
Was it cool?
Yeah.
And that was the first glimpse you ever got of the outside world.
Do you remember what life was like outside of the camp?
Not really.
She was one.
One. What do you remember, if anything?
I don't even remember nothing.
Nothing?
No.
And then, after the hour, they were turned around and brought back. And so I think all of them, you know, are sort of in a state of shock. They expected to be going home, and now they've been brought back to this detention facility.
How did you feel when they turned this
way? I felt heartbreaking. I was so upset. I was crying to my mom. I was saying, I don't want to come back to the camp, to the prison.
Does it feel like a prison?
Yeah. I thought we were going. But then I don't know how we just turned back.
Zahra Ahmed, one of the Australian women from Melbourne, a mother of three, she told us that when she was returned, she was in a state of shock. She collapsed to the ground. She suffered what she described as a seizure, just from the frustration and the fear of what comes next. And the other kids as well had similar reactions. One of her sons, Mohammed, who's 14.
I felt free, and then when I came back, I felt sad.
Described how his hands started going numb for a few days after. He didn't feel well.
I don't really know. It was shocking. Like, I couldn't believe it, and then we came back.
Did you ever think you were going to get out of the camp?
Yeah, but I don't think it would be like this. Like going in a car and then come back.
And all of the kids, when we asked them about how they felt coming back, had very emotional reactions. We talked to one girl, Beida. She's 11 years old.
Yeah. At that time, I was so happy we were leaving. But then...
she struggled to get the words out. She started crying almost immediately.
When we came back, I was so sad and upset. It's terrible. I started crying. Why do I have to be in there? I don't want to be in tents. I don't want to be in a camp. I don't want to be in a prison. It's so hard to live in here. I just want to go and be free. And live in houses and live a normal life, not like here. There's not a lot of things to do.
The overwhelming sense I got from sitting with these kids for a long time is that they don't know why they're there. Their mothers told us that they've tried to shield them from the political, I guess, furor in Australia that's been kicked off over the past week, as well as the reasons for why they're in Syria?
No. I have never actually known why I'm here. I don't know. My mom said it was supposed to be a vacation. Then we got stuck here.
Do you know why you're here in this camp?
No. I don't.
No.
I asked a few of them, do you know what ISIS is?
No. My mom never told me about him.
No.
Never heard about it?
No. No, I don't.
And I asked them, you know, do you know why you returned?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. For real, if you're doing that, you won't think about turning around at all. Like, if you're already out, you don't think that you'll turn back around.
But, I mean, you know, what did your mom explain to you about what happened?
I don't know. My mom really didn't talk.
I spoke to their mothers and I said, how are you going to explain it to them? They said, we still don't know. We're still trying to wrap our heads around it. And what's clear is that, you know, looking at Australian politics the past week, it's all been a debate over these kids and the mothers. And, you know, there's a lot of details there. There's proposed laws and it escapes them. It's very black and white. What they know is that they're stuck in a prison camp and they want to live a good life. They want to have a future. They want to be. But for some reason, they're being kept there and they don't know why.
Mm. They were clearly distressed about being turned around. What did they say about their dreams or their hopes about eventually making it to Australia?
Yeah, I think in some respects, they're really normal kids. You know, Asya, for example, she said her biggest dream is to be on Australia's Got Talent.
I want to be on Australia's Got Talent and get the golden buzzer.
The golden buzzer?
Yeah.
For dancing or for singing?
For both.
For both?
Yeah.
Apparently she really loves Frozen, like any other kid does.
Sing it, come on.
She sang a song for us.
I'm coming home, tell the world that I'm coming home. Let the rain wash away all the pain from yesterday.
It's a beautiful song. Do you make it yourself?
No.
Where'd you hear it?
On TV.
So you're happy to go home?
Yeah.
And then 12-year-old Omar said he wants to be a demo man.
A what?
Demolition man.
Demolition man? Why?
I like breaking stuff.
Like any 12-year-old would?
You don't have a big hammer and get to break up houses?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Did you ever get to do any of that here?
Play ball.
Play ball?
Yeah. That's, I think, the only thing that we do here. That's when I'm outside.
Are you bored a lot here?
Yes.
You know, others, they want to be doctors, they want to work in robotics.
But I know my grandpa has a farm and he has a garden and I want to swim in my grandma's pool. I want to do gardening with my grandfather.
Mm.
And you know, one of the kids told me that he dreams about going on long walks and riding his bike.
Do you have a bike here?
Yeah.
But I imagine there's not a lot of places you can go.
Yeah.
Because their lives are confined to a little square kilometer box. But in other ways, they're very much not normal kids.
Do you feel similar to other Australian kids?
No.
Why not?
I don't know, because they're like, no, because they're free and I'm not.
You know, I asked Omar, the 12-year-old, what do you want to do when you get to Australia? And first of all, he didn't know much about Australia.
When you picture Australia, what do you think about?
Fun times.
Like what? Going to the beach?
No, not at all.
You don't want to go to the beach? What's fun time then?
I don't know. Just doing, staying with my family.
Yeah.
He knew he had grandparents. He knew that they have a beautiful garden. He wanted to hang out with them. He wanted to do barbecues. And he said he wanted a phone.
You want to download Instagram?
I don't know. I don't even know what's on it. I just know games and movies.
Do you know what Instagram is?
No.
Which blew my mind. Because what 12-year-old doesn't know what Instagram is? And it's funny because you see the way that they experience the world is mostly through TV. And their conception of Australia is through TV. I mean, they mentioned this show that probably Australians know better, but Bluey and Dingo or something like this. and they see malls on TV, but they've never stepped foot in a mall. And so you sort of get the sense that they have in their head that there's Australia that is this paradise to them because they've heard about it from their mothers.
Iron says to go to the beach and eat ice cream, go to the restaurants.
What are you going
to get? Do a lot of stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What are you going to get at the restaurants?
I don't know.
Yeah. French fries.
I don't really know what kind of foods are in Australia.
You don't know what foods are in Australia?
No.
What do you know about Australia?
I know Australia's a beautiful country. There's kind people.
But they've never experienced it. And they haven't experienced most of the world. You know, I was talking to Leila, who's six, and she talked about how when she left the camp briefly, that she put down the window and she was inhaling the air and she was describing the things she saw.
But what did you taste when you were in the car?
Sweet air, but then I vomited.
You ate too much?
Because I ate too much.
But what did it look like outside the camp? What do you remember?
It looked like so nice. There was a drink shop.
What about the trees?
The trees, I didn't see any trees. Mm-hmm. I saw a donkey. How do you say baby
horse? She was talking about how she saw what she said was a baby horse.
A little horse, that's what you said.
No, it's trolley. It's a dolly.
But she didn't know the word for it.
A pony?
A polly.
A pony.
Okay, a pony.
Is it the first time you saw a pony?
She had never seen a pony. She had never seen cows. She had never seen houses. So it's just, I think it's shocking for us to try to understand what sort of life they're living.
We'll be right back. These children have lived many years in confinement. Were you able to interview their mothers?
So we sat with their mothers and we spoke to their mothers, but their moms are under advice by their lawyers not to give comments to media because their cases are, you know, ongoing in Australia. And the mothers, their primary concern seems to be the well-being of their children. And, you know, even we spoke to Zahra and some of the other women. And what they said is that, you know, they're so desperate for their kids to get out that they're willing to be separated from them if necessary. You know, if a worst case scenario in which they weren't able to go home, but their kids were, they would want that to happen just so their kids can live a better future and they can stop living in fear. Zahra described how her children have constant stress throughout the day. They're constantly in fear of the other kids, of the mothers who might be affiliated with ISIS, and just the general stress of the camp, and said that, you know, her 12-year-old son, Ahmad, has started wetting the bed. Which she describes as a symptom of just constant stress throughout the day, and that he bites his fingernails until they're bloody nubs. And so, you know, they're in a lot of stress watching their kids just deteriorate. And I will say that while some of the mothers said that they would be willing to be separated, not all of them said that. You know, that obviously it's a very difficult choice for a mother to be separated from their children.
The Australian government, the Australian Prime Minister, insists that Australia will not be providing these families with assistance, although they are entitled as citizens to Australian passports. Why are humanitarian groups increasingly anxious about countries repatriating their citizens from this camp? What do they say are the risks if that does not happen?
For years, humanitarians have said that countries need to take back their citizens, and for a couple of reasons. One, because there's a security risk. ISIS is constantly trying to smuggle out families, trying to get families and recruit them back into the organization. And a lot of these kids, you know, okay, the Australians, you know, they try to raise their kids outside of the ISIS ideology, but there are known radical women in the camp. And they try to raise this new generation as ISIS kids. And so there's a fear that if these kids stay in here forever, they'll grow up in that ideology. And the second thing is that, you know, we're arriving to a point in Syria where it might not be possible to keep people in camps indefinitely. You know, for years, people have warned countries that they need to take their citizens back before it's too late. And we might have reached the point where it's almost too late. You know, we saw a whole camp get emptied out. Among its residents were 6,000 foreign women and children. Now we don't know where they are. They're somewhere in Syria. Some have already escaped to Turkey, smuggled themselves over. Some have gone to Lebanon, presented themselves to embassies. One showed up in Brussels. And so, you know, governments are missing their chance to manage repatriation of their of these individuals. Some of them who have links to ISIS, they're missing their chance to do it in a managed way. And instead, it's going to be chaotic from a security perspective, and also from the perspective of protecting these children. I mean, we don't know who smuggled these kids out. We don't know where they are. Are they being held by radical foreign fighters somewhere in Idlib? Are they being re-indoctrinated into the group? Are they vulnerable to trafficking, some of these young girls? We don't know. And these are risks. And these are some of the risks that their mothers, the Australians and others we spoke to in the camp, said that they're very frightened about. You know, if the same thing happens that happened to Al-Hol, and all of a sudden people are being taken out left or right, they're afraid that they're going to lose control of their kids and that they themselves might be put in a vulnerable situation. And so they're very eager to get home before it's too late.
There are certainly lessons to be learned from the closure of Al-Hol. There are many politicians here who say that these families should not be brought to Australia, that they would pose a risk. In one case, a politician has said that nobody would want them as their neighbours, despite previous groups returning in 2022 and 2019 with no known issues arising. You've spent time with these families, with these children. I wonder, Will, what have you observed? What would you say in response to some of those political remarks?
Oh, what I would say is that this seems to be a political issue that's become a media object rather than one that's based off of, let's say, security and humanitarian considerations. And when you listen to statements from groups like Save the Children Australia, where they talk about the legal obligations and the moral obligations that the Australian government has to these women, and particularly to the children, you know, the facts seem pretty clear. But sitting with these Australian women and their children, when we talk about the women, they all said that they want to come back and they're ready to face a court. You know, if there's any evidence against them, they're ready to stand trial and face whatever consequences they need to. And it's clear, you know, Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister, said that one of these women had a TEO put against her, which indicates that they have specific intelligence on each of these women and that they have the capacity to deal with them. You know, law enforcement has capacity to deal with them. So that's the women. The second thing is the kids. You know, whatever the sins of the father, of the mother might be, these are innocent kids. These, some of them were born in Syria. Some of them were, you know, 2 months old when they were brought there. And they don't understand why they're there. And they're being left to rot there. And, you know, there's that famous phrase that Albanese said, that they made their bed and they need to lie in it. But I don't think these kids made their bed. And they don't understand what that even means. They don't understand why they're being blamed for something. And, you know, I asked some of the kids, I said, there are some people that blame you for being here. They say it's your fault. What do you say to that? What would you tell them?
I'll say, it's not, and don't talk to me. Come to the camp and see how I felt. They realize how hard my life was, and they should appreciate their life in Australia.
William Christou, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was journalist William Christou in Syria. Badr Khan Ahmad also contributed to this story. You can find more of their reporting on theguardian.com, and we've linked to their latest piece on the full story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria. Sound design and mixing by Joe Koenig. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also leave us a review. I'm Noor Haider. Catch you next time.